Hey, so we've been wanting to record this episode for you for a really long time, and we're really excited for you to listen. So let's get right into
Welcome to Wellness Myths. Today we have Aaron Flores. He is a registered dietitian with a private practice in Calabasas, California. He also works at Center for Discovery as a senior coordinator for weight inclusive care. He uses intuitive eating and health at every size in his work to help individuals learn how to make peace with food and their bodies. He is a certified body trust provider, and he also is the co-host of the popular podcast Dietitians Unplugged. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. And I'm doubly excited because basically 20% of the reason why I reached out was because you had an Instagram post with a West Wing shirt on.
Only 20%?
Yeah. Okay, maybe like 40%.
All right. Thank you.
An important distinction because that's one of my favorite shows ever.
Oh my, I'm like such a wing nut. It's a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, it was like my parents were really into it, and then my husband was really into it, and they're like, you have to watch this. Like, I'm only 25. I don't even know like when it came out. I was probably really young, but I got into it like late in the game, and I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, no, it's something I tell everyone, like, no, you have to watch The West Wing. It's just maybe the best TV ever.
Yeah, it totally is.
I think some of the like dirtiest glares I've ever gotten from my husband is if I've asked to watch something else when he was watching West Wing, because I admittedly never got into it. I never, you know, it's like once you don't watch the first episode and you're not into it, you're kind of out. And I think those are probably some of the dirtiest glares that I've gotten from him.
I could see that.
Craig does love The West Wing. I talk about it with her husband because she doesn't watch it. So our listeners are pretty familiar with intuitive eating and health at every size. We talk about it like every other word, but less so with the framework of body trust. So could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a certification that I received from Be Nourished, who are a couple of folks out in Portland, Oregon, Hillary Canavy and Dana Sturdivant. And the certification is basically a framework where, you know, principles of intuitive eating and health at every size are included, but it adds a really in-depth and an important social justice lens to all of this. So it incorporates an understanding of the impact of weight stigma on the individual. It also brings in some, you know, some trauma-informed care philosophies, as well as feminist theory of therapy, in addition to a lot of other things. And that's sort of like the back end part of it. The sort of the front end, or I think what resonates with me and the people that engage in it with me is I think it's a coming home to your body. It's a reclamation of a trust that was lost maybe earlier in life for a lot of understandable reasons. It's acknowledging that the relationship with our body is one that needs to be nurtured, and it needs to be nurtured with a lot of compassion and kindness and non-judgment. And it's a relationship that has been broken on the backs of diet culture and fat phobia. And for me, what was really powerful about body trust and embracing it for myself, doing the certification and then practicing from it now, is it provides a context for some really uncomfortable, difficult, but healing conversations around bodies in our society. And I wasn't finding that in any other training or even approach towards body image. I was finding most other things that I found were very surface level and not centering fat bodies in the discussion. It was, you know, this discussion of bodies from a perspective of a smaller body or a thin body that didn't resonate with me and doesn't resonate with a lot of my clients.
It's almost like when these really thin, usually white women post like their, you know, body kind of contorted around to appear larger just so they can kind of like glom onto this movement that was never really started for that specific person anyways.
Yeah. And so it's I don't know. It provided like language for me in doing this work. It provided community in doing this work. It provided a lot of context for why this is such a struggle.
It's almost like with intuitive eating and health at every size, it can be a little more on the individual level. And this sounds more like a collective awakening type of vibe.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's parts of that for sure. And I think there is a lot of individual work within body trust as well. And I think it's embracing the importance of both, at least for me, right? That's how I've, you know, how I use it, how I like to interpret it and apply it.
Yeah.
I'm curious too, in your education and in your opinion, when do you think that trust or relationship with your body starts to break down? I mean, we've seen it at pretty young ages, but how young do you think that begins to happen?
It's a really good question. And, you know, some of the research points to, you know, as early as 5 and 6, when kids are beginning to understand what is a good body versus a bad body, what kind of bodies are acceptable in this world. So I think it happens when we're too young to really have the tools to know what's happening. I would say in that age range, right, of 5, 6, I think definitely during adolescence, it is very challenging and hard for folks. I think I see it a lot with folks as they start to build autonomy from their family and some individuation. So, you know, I think it's really understandable to see that trust begin to erode in childhood and adolescence.
I think I noticed so much, especially that age when kids are kind of figuring out that other people might be different than them and they're kind of really loud about commenting on those differences. And I've seen multiple times when kids will be like, oh, that person's fat or something like that. And the parent is very quick to be like, don't say that. Like, that's such a bad word. And that's not something that, you know, we use. And that's such an insult or whatever. And I feel like that's kind of just cementing for them that that's not something that you can say.
Yeah. And I think those experiences happen as a parent. My kids are 13 now. I noticed that there were really subtle body messages, even in homework at like first grade and second grade. And I noticed it around, you know, in the school system, like around curriculum, you know, there were like examples of, you know, oh, this is healthy, this is not healthy. And yes, for sure, from families too, about, you know, how language is going to be used.
Thinking back even to myself, I remember being really, really young. One of my first friends who I probably met when I was in preschool, and I don't know if they still have sizing like this now, but then there was like regular size and there was slim, and I was not a slim and my friend was a slim. And I remember thinking about that and thinking, I wish my pants were slim. And I was like 5 years old.
Again, it's like something that kids are not really prepared for, and parents, you know, I'm going to say any adult, unless they've done a lot of work, might not really be prepared, again, to like, how do we name these things that are happening to us, onto us, often without consent, and have a discussion about how this is affecting us and how problematic it is.
Mm-hmm. And I think now, you know, we have this body positive movement going on. And it seems like, especially on social media, it's mainly women are represented. How do you think we can change that so men feel represented in that space as well?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And the answer is I don't know yet, to be honest. I think it's a really larger question than what we see on social media, but also how we can move in to discussing this and acknowledging the effects of fat phobia on all bodies. And, you know, I think the typical narrative, because there is a lot of misogyny in diet culture, and it has affected female identified folks in a much different way, more prolonged time that it's just a more acceptable conversation to come into. And I think for male identified folks, because it's rather relatively new that diet culture has emphasized so much on the male body, that I think there's just less framework and acceptance for this is a topic that it's okay to discuss. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing that I find is that, and it's sort of like the same thing that you mentioned earlier, is because there aren't as many voices discussing this, we're looking for, okay, what's the answer to the male body image experience? And the answer is it's varied. It's not one narrative. It's not one story. It's a very complex and, you know, nuanced discussion that needs many voices. We need, you know, voices of different races. We need voices of different gender identities. We need different body sizes. We need different socioeconomic discussions around this. And what I'm finding is that it is impacting folks, and it is impacting them in a really negative way. There's just this sort of desert of possibilities to have an open discussion about it. And when a lot of folks, male identified folks, try to have this conversation, they're shut down in a lot of ways and it's dismissed. I think especially because of how the fitness industry targets male identified folks, and how like this whole bro culture, biohacking, life hacking bullshit shows up around male identified folks as well.
My husband is a programmer, and he's definitely not a brogrammer, mm-hmm. which is like that specific type that's like into that hyper optimizing.
Yeah.
Everything has to be so efficient, and they start to apply that to the body.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely had some interesting conversations with people that he's worked with or known over the years about that.
Yeah. I mean, those are the dudes who invented Soylent.
Yes, Soylent. It was like in his college
house.
He lived with like 8 other dudes. And I remember seeing the Soylent, and I remember them being like, this is like changing my life. I'm like, I mean, it's like canola oil and a bunch of other random stuff. I just don't see how it's like changing everything. But for them, it was like just about the convenience of not even having to worry or connect with the body at all.
Right. Which is such a problem.
Yeah, such a problem. I'm curious how the Soylent people are doing right now.
Could they have come up with a better name too? Like Soylent sounds like something I should put on my car if it's not running very well. Like, you know, I think you're low on Soylent, and or it sounds like something I might have learned in like when I was working at the hospital. Like, oh, that's a level 2 Soylent in the room. You might want to put on some hazard clothes.
Yeah, or it kind of sounds like a tube feed or something.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I mean, it kind of basically is.
Mm-hmm.
For people who don't know, Soylent is just a little beverage that you can drink supposedly in place of meals.
Don't do it.
No Soylent. We're against Soylent. You were talking about that conversation and having people, you know, relate to each other. And you run a type of male identifying body image group, right?
Yeah, I do. I just call it a men's body trust group. And I run it like a support group. And we have, you know, a small number of folks participating. I try to keep it, you know, under 10 minutes. And it's really a place to just check in every other week and see how folks are doing and experiencing life in their body. And really, like, the discussions that come up in that group are amazing. I mean, it gives such a clear picture of how this is impacting folks. And, you know, when we can find the space to actually talk about it in a non-judgmental way, there is some shared, you know, Kristen Neff calls it common humanity, right? We see that, oh, I'm not the only one experiencing this, and I'm not the only one suffering from this. And if I can, you know, share my story, I realize, oh, this other person sort of feels the same way. I'm not alone in this struggle anymore. And I think it makes a really, really important entry piece for that self-compassion that we all need.
So in your groups, what are some, if you can or don't mind telling us, what are some common things that you're finding male identifying people are really struggling with?
Everything. I mean, I hate to be so broad there, but everything. I mean, I think what I've appreciated from the groups that I've run so far is if the space feels comfortable and safe, folks really are willing to talk about everything, right? No topic is off the table, and no topic is, I mean, it might be uncomfortable, right? But no topic is too vulnerable to bring up. And so, you know, there've really been really in-depth, meaningful, vulnerable conversations. And I guess I would just sort of summarize it in this way, is that if, and this is for anyone, right? It doesn't matter who the clients we are working with, or if you're a client trying to find a provider or a group, is if whoever's leading it or the facilitator or the other members involved can feel safe and comfortable and know that within the confines of this group or in my session with my dietitian or therapist, that it's okay to go there, is that people, I think, do want to talk about these things. And when we find that safe space, it becomes really, really not easy, but like, it's almost like it gives us permission to embrace the real brave conversations that we're thirsty for.
It seems like, too, as we were kind of mentioning earlier, diet culture is so patriarchal. And so the group that you're providing for people who I think a lot of the times shoulder the burden of the blame always, and we don't realize that male identifying people are affected by all of this stuff. Absolutely. As well, in different ways. And so I'm sure that's so valuable for them to have this kind of safe space where they don't have to worry about, oh, do I suffer enough from this? That's really cool.
No, it's an important distinction to name for folks too, is that, you know, we can suffer from patriarchy, right? We are affected by it as well. Again, it's different, but it's still there. And it's still one of those forces that is showing up in our society that is a form of oppression.
So it makes me think of, I just saw an article about the COVID-19 vaccine and how toxic masculinity is endangering lots of people's lives because it's causing a lot of male identifying people to feel that they don't need a vaccination. And I think that is just a really great stark example of how powerful and dangerous toxic masculinity can be.
Yeah, I had not heard that. And I don't know. I guess it's nothing surprises me anymore over the past year and couple months. And it's also really sad. You know, it's really sad that, again, I think the way in which masculinity has been, how male identifying people have been socialized around masculinity is so hard to unravel. And it's so, you know, again, it's like, as I do this work and I talk about, you know, these things I mentioned earlier, right? Compassion and non-judgment and curiosity, right? Those are, it seems like, not the kryptonite, but like masculinity holds up a force field to those, right? And the masculinity in the sense of, I'm not allowed to feel feelings. I'm not allowed to, right, explore deeper things. It's that type of masculinity. And I think the reality is that masculinity includes those things, but people have this such a rigid view of what it means to be a man in this world that that can't be embraced when I think it wholeheartedly should be.
I think that for so many men, it's like they're almost sometimes these feelings are so unacceptable in society for them to have that it's just kind of bubbling under the surface and they don't even know what's going on really, because we've kind of forced that socialization, as you're mentioning, to just kind of push it down. And oh, that's not masculine to have something like compassion or, you know, understanding or self-care, all those things. I don't see men like in the bath with a face mask on being like, my self-care today, you know, like it's just not as prevalent in.
Yeah. And maybe that self-care is going to look different. Right. And I think, as you said, sort of like living, you know, not being in touch. Right. I think the body trust language to me there is, you know, not being able to inhabit the space below your neck, that I only inhabit the space above my neck. That's where it's safe. That's where it's comfortable. For me to drop down into my body is very unsafe. And I think, you know, I think that's part of where I think people see self-care, right, in just one way, when in reality, self-care might be, listen, I am going to take some time off, right? And I need to like do something alone. And it might not be a bath, right? But it might be like, listen, I'm going to go hit golf balls for an hour, right? Or I am going to like not check work email after 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And I'm going to be like fully present at home. And I'm going to like give myself a lunch break, right? It's like, it's some of these things and I realize that that's a pretty privileged statement, depending on how you work and what you do for work. But I think there's this idea of like, it's just slowing down, right? It's just being able to say like, I think this is what I need right now. Like I might need to just like take some deep breaths and take a glass of water, or I might need to go out and like hit a punching bag for like 20 minutes, right? Like self-care can take many forms. That's where the curiosity comes in, right? Of like, what is going to help me feel more or allow myself to feel more connected to my body?
Yeah, I think that's so valuable to mention, because so many times we think of like, I need to add more or do more or, you know, whatever it is. But sometimes, like you said, it's just stopping and maybe taking that time to take breaths or stopping to assess just what your needs are in that moment.
100%.
So I know Emily and I both in our female friendships find that our female friends that have male identifying partners struggle with body image and then end up, you know, it's either a cycle of maybe eating a lot for gains and going to the gym all the time, or they're trying to lean out. And it for some, it seems like they're always stuck in that kind of cycle. And I think they're not really talking about it a lot, but that can't be a great space to be in.
No, no. I mean, I think, you know, the cycle of diet culture is it's so predictable. It's intense. And when folks are starting it, it feels sort of euphoric. Right? It feels like this is what I've been searching for. But very soon after, it doesn't feel that way. And I really think that one of the things that perpetuates this cycle, especially amongst a lot of male identified folks, is that there's no other option for them, right? It's like, oh, if I want to try to eat differently or have a different relationship with my body or move my body, it automatically fits into this narrative of, okay, I got to go to the gym. I got to lift. I got to have, you know, now I got to start counting macros. I got to like pay attention to how much, you know, protein I consume before and after workouts. I got to have a cheat day. Again, it sort of fits into this biohacking stuff. And that's the presentation, or it's like, oh, I'm going to go to like Weight Watchers, right? Because that's what my partner has done or whatever. There's no other option. And I think as for when one partner has sort of divested from diet culture and said, I'm going to do something differently. We sometimes really hope that our partner is going to like leap into it with us. And sometimes it doesn't happen that way. And that is really hard. It's like really challenging. And I think for those folks who have done that, right, who've sort of leapt out of diet culture and into this more healing space around food and body, is understanding, like sort of reflecting how much work it took for me to take that leap. And what I can hope for, right, with my partner is that they can start that process. And, you know, sometimes we can't force them to have it as quickly as we want it to, but it is so helpful for us when they do embrace this work as well, because it, you know, becomes a space where bodies are celebrated in a very different way than how diet culture tells us. So it's a great thing when our partners are there with us, but sometimes there's a really tough path to get there for a lot of folks. And I think making space for that journey, right, to take that leap away and come out of diet culture takes a lot of time. And sometimes the best we can do is to just model, right, share how this is impacting us and set boundaries, right? Here's what I don't want you to talk about, right? When it comes to bodies around me, here's what is really helpful, what is not helpful, and here's what I'm trying to do, here's why, and I hope you can support me.
When I started on this journey, my husband was very supportive, and he was like, oh, this seems great, and I'm just gonna like do whatever you do kind of thing. But at times, you know, it's hard because it almost, which I see so much with the anti-diet dietitians or therapists and whatever, almost becomes like another set of rigidity that we just traded all those food rules and judgment for. And then now we're ending like judging the other people that haven't quite made it there yet.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important to watch out for too, because it's easy to do.
Yeah.
with a partner, especially.
Totally. And you know, it's especially hard as we do this, right? Because we're fearful of, is this going to change my relationship, right? How much of, like, if my body changes, is my partner still going to find me attractive? Or are they going to think of my body differently? And I think what I hope this work brings for everyone is, again, the ability to lean into these conversations, right? The ability to like name how these things might show up for us, and finding partners where we can, you know, lean into like some really challenging conversations. But as we move through them, right, it deepens sort of that relationship. It can provide a very, again, that safer space to have our bodies show up for each other.
What do you think, maybe, and I don't know if you have any off the top of your head here, but with starting, you know, tougher conversations like that with a partner, how do you think, do you have any advice for conversation starters or something that a partner could say to be supportive?
Yeah. I'm a dietitian, right? And a body trust provider. I'm not a couples therapist. And so I think the things that sort of come to mind are just sort of anecdotal, but I think the things that I've found both useful in my relationship, but also in supporting clients, is one of the early things that my partner and I did before we got married was went to like this sort of pre-marriage class, and the therapist running it talked about signposting. And signposting we use all the time in our house. It's like, I'm going to tell you something, and after it, all I need you to say is, wow, that sucks. I'm so sorry. Right. And it's sort of like giving, sort of priming the response we want, instead of leaving it up to the person to try to sit with it, right? Or provide some feedback. And I think in some ways, being able to feed the answer to folks as we share the experience of being in our body is really helpful. Hey, I'm going to tell you some things about how I'm feeling in my body that are, you know, I don't need you to fix it. I don't need you to tell me what to do. All I need you to say is, oh, I'm so sorry. That's really hard to deal with. I'm here to support you. And, you know, I think so much of this is, I think diet culture teaches us, as well as other things, but diet culture really teaches us to not be very comfortable with discomfort, right? If you're feeling uncomfortable about your body, well, then here's the fix. And it doesn't allow us any space or any tools to hold space for difficult feelings. And I think for me, a lot of my work is less fixing and more holding space, you know, more holding space for what it means to live in a fat phobic world. What does it mean to experience weight stigma and to try and not internalize it anymore? How do we make space for grieving the body that we once had or that we held on a pedestal that we know we might never be able to achieve? And how do we grieve the harm that we might have done to ourselves through diet culture? And I think if we can, partners especially, can be able to hold space for those very powerful feelings, I think that's how we build a deeper connection and knowing that, oh, I can share this, right? By me sharing and me being comfortable sharing, I am going to feel, it's going to help it be a little bit better, right, to navigate this. And I think this is where like Brené Brown's work is so useful in many ways, because it's about that vulnerability and leaning into that vulnerability.
Yeah, I think that's so important to mention, because so many times as humans in general, I think we just want to jump right into problem solving. Like, you told me your issue, I need to think of something to solve that right away. And sometimes it's not about that, because we're not going to have the answers. So it's just, like you said, holding that space and providing support and validation.
So this kind of burning question, one of our last ones for you.
Yeah.
So many people all the time say, I love my body so much, but I still want to change it. What advice do you have for people who are still not quite ready to give up the pursuit of weight loss, but they want to start a body acceptance journey? And is that even possible?
It's such a common question. I get it as well. And how I approach that question is, of course, you still want to lose weight. Like, it's understandable, right? We value a smaller body in this world more than a larger body. And I think there's healthism in this, right? This idea that a smaller body is a healthy body, and health is, and the pursuit of health is a moral obligation, right? Yes. And if you're not striving towards that, somehow you're failing.
Yes. Or you just don't care about yourself.
Right. I think this narrative. Yeah. This, and which is complete and utter like bullshit. Right. But I think that, so healthism shows up in this. I think weight stigma shows up in this. And I think I just want to validate for those folks who are listening and feeling that, like, oh, yes, I want to accept my body and I still want to change it, is it's understandable to feel that way, right? We've been in diet culture for years. Pulling ourselves out sometimes takes a lot and a lot of time. So of course you're going to want to try to lose weight. It's really okay to feel that way. The next thing is to think about, what was my experience like on a diet? What did it feel like? What were the pros and what were the cons? And once I met any sort of success, one, was it achievable for a long time? Was it sustainable? And two, did it really make everything better? And it might make some things better, right? It might, yeah, you might be able to shop somewhere that you weren't able to shop at before. You might be able to get on a ride at an amusement park that you didn't get on before. Dating could be easier, right? All of these things, I think, are important to validate that because of weight stigma, yes, our society makes these things easier, but it's not sustainable, right? You're gonna, most likely you will regain the weight. And then what's going to happen? How are you going to feel then? So to me, I think, again, holding space, I think it's important to really piece out or like pull apart. Why is this desire or the pursuit of weight loss so important? And let's be curious about why. Let's be curious about what could happen, but again, from a pros and cons list of diving back into diet culture. You know, I think one of the things that is really, I guess can be sort of underlying all of this is the idea that, I don't know how I want to say this. the idea that we must have body acceptance for all bodies as we do this. And I think that's why some folks will choose body liberation, fat liberation, fat activism, fat acceptance. This is about, you know, for someone in a larger body to do something as radical as accept the body they're in and give up the pursuit of weight loss is something that is not really acceptable in our society. And when someone engages in that pursuit or that choice, they're taking their lived experience and how they're going to navigate the world from a really different lens. And a lot of folks are not going to be okay with it, but it's not up to them. Right? It's up to the person. And body acceptance and fat acceptance doesn't mean you're throwing away or you don't care about your health. It just means my pursuit of health is going to be the way I want it to be, and it's not going to include weight loss. And that, again, those are radical things to accept and say and for people to hear. And so I see it as a continuum, right? I think we need to allow people to really be curious about why weight loss still holds such a feeling, right? And drive for them, and help them understand how that external message has become internalized. And I will say this, that I think that the end game for a lot of folks in this is that there is no end game. Right. I don't think you get to like a point in like body acceptance or fat liberation where weight stigma doesn't impact you. Right. It still impacts you. I think you just have different tools and ways of dealing with that rather than going straight to weight loss. Right. So I think we just need to be honest with people too, is that like, it doesn't mean these thoughts never show up again. It doesn't mean life is unicorns and rainbows. It just means that how you're going to navigate it is going to come from a very different paradigm.
And that the external world that has kind of perpetuated the stigma might stay the same. So these triggers are still going to be there. It's just, you know, how to manage them a little better.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And then lastly, any resources that you'd like to share to folks to get started on the journey of body acceptance? If you're like, I have no idea where to even begin.
Podcasts like this are essential. I mean, really, I think so many of us learn through conversations. So, you know, listening to podcasts like this is great. I mean, I think is a big, big step for a lot of folks. If you like reading, I think books like Body Respect by Lindo Bacon and Lucy Aframore are great. I love Body Is Not an Apology by Sonia Renee Taylor. Kisei Lehman wrote a book called Heavy, which is a great memoir of a Black man in a larger body. I think you know, checking out Be Nourished and doing their No More Waiting course is a great, you know, entry point into this. They run it multiple times throughout the year. I would also say, if you are interested in joining my men's group, that's a great option for folks. And I think, you know, going down sort of the rabbit hole of once you read some of those books, to really like say, okay, now what's the next voice that's going to add to this narrative, add to this story for me? And where does my voice fit in?
And we can certainly link those books and such in our show notes if anyone is interested in those. And Erin, if anyone is interested in your group or finding you on social media, where can they find you?
You'll find me on Instagram and you'll find me very inactive. But I'm there. my Instagram handle is at Erin Flores, RDN. And I post semi unregularly, whatever that means, but there's some stuff up there. And if you, want to check out my website, it's, www.smashthewaitriarchy.com. And you can also email me at erinfloresrdn@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And yeah, check Erin out if you haven't already. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Wellness Myths. Please remember to like, review, and subscribe. See you next time.